Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Good evening, John.
And a very good evening to you, Ben, and hi, everybody.
And our email address, as ever, is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie, and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032. You can catch us, I was going to say live on the internet, but now you can catch us as a podcast, but I'm told the website will be back up, new and improved, very shortly. Taking a bit longer than I was originally told. But anyway, that's another story. So we'll get cracking on with it and talk about what to see in the sky now that the nights are closing in pretty, well, I was not pretty fast because I was just, it was a lovely, well, it wasn't quite cloudy last night, it was but 10:20 past. Mm. I think it was 25 to 11 or so, and I was looking out, thinking, "That's nice." And well, we wouldn't call it bright exactly, but it wasn't dark.
So. Yeah, I got to see the space station a couple of evenings. Well, I should say early hours of the morning, around 3 o'clock, 3 o'clock over the weekend. Just by pure chance, I'm quite lucky that way. Just look up and see the introduction to the sky of the International Space Station. Just point to yourself south, look up right, and at the designated time it comes in, you can do like me, just take a chance. And I did, and I saw two nights in a row over the weekend as well. Lovely sight to see as well. There were good long passes as well. I reckon over 4 minutes, I would have thought. So a good thing to see. So Mercury, unfortunately, sinking back down to and out of sight in the globe. It's the sunset at the moment, so you're not getting a good chance to see that. Venus, it's a brilliant sight at minus 4.1. It rises above the east-northeast horizon about half an hour or more before the first glimmer of dawn. And Venus climbs higher until the sky, until the dawn grows a little bit too bright when it just decides to disappear. So if you want to look at it through a telescope, it's shrinking globe. It's only about 16 arc seconds pole to pole and is about 65% sunlit at the moment. Mars, on the other hand, magnitude 1.5, quite dim. It glows low in the west in late twilight and sets soon after dark. And Jupiter, -1.9. It's creeping back into our nighttime viewing, as Saturn will be as well. And it's great to see these. It's amazing how quickly that these move through the sky. So the most of them are all morning ones at the moment. And later on this week, as dawn grows bright, try to find it about three fists to the lower left of Venus. So they are all quite close to each other. And the best time to try a telescope on Saturn is just before dawn, when Saturn is time to get about 40 degrees high while still in a dark or nearly dark sky. You may be surprised by the look of Saturn. Its rings are nearly edge on to us this year. Now, it's a good sight to see edge on. It's even better when it's sort of tilted at us a little way as well. So preference there, it doesn't really matter. We get what we get, but Saturn is still a fantastic sight to see. Uranus 5.8, very dim. It's invisibly dim in the dawn background of Venus. As Neptune, as they still call it, the telescopic star at a magnitude of 7.9, it lurks in Saturn's background just 1 degree from it. So catch this outermost major planet just before dawn begins. So Saturn is going to rise at around midnight pretty soon. I'm not sure if it's tonight or tomorrow night. It's very close to swinging around quickly. So most of them have been morning viewing, but now they're turning into be the late evening.
As a general rule, they rise about 3 minutes earlier every night, the further out planets like. John, I'm just after, looking here on heavensabove.com. Get tonight's pass for the ISS beginning at 11:20. 11:23 and until 11:30. 30 degrees up, maximum of 30 degrees up, mm-hmm. and a magnitude of -3.0, which is quite bright. And you'll see it above the moon. The moon will be quite low at 26 minutes past 11 this evening. Mm-hmm. It's that bright object passing above the moon from our point of view. Speaking of the moon, it's 96% waxing gibbous, because we're coming up to the full moon shortly. That'll be actually on Thursday at 9:46 p.m. to be precise. But at the moment it's nearly full, 96% waxing gibbous, but it's not above our horizon at the moment. But it actually will rise in about 20 minutes time at about 8:52 p.m. Which is, about 20 minutes or so from now. And it will be due south at its highest throughout its path tonight at just before midnight, 10 to midnight this evening. And when it sets tomorrow at 10 minutes to 3 in the morning, it will have risen to about 97% phase. Not that you'd notice, between 96 and 97%. And it will rise again. When it rises again tomorrow at 9:45, it'll be 99%. So as I mentioned, which is basically when it's full moon. And we have, of course, the sun rising tomorrow in Dublin at 5:09 in the morning, which is a whole 7 minutes later than this time last week. And local noon, when the sun is due south of us and at its highest, that's 1:30 p.m. And the sun sets at 9:51 p.m., which is 4 minutes earlier than a week ago. And then we have various shades, shall we say, of twilight all evening. No astronomical night until the end of the month. So we'll have 10 minutes more daylight tomorrow than a week ago. Another 1:52 less daylight than today, when there'll be 16:42 between sunrise and sunset. Just before I finish on the moon and the sun, on Thursday, which I mentioned is the full moon, it'll be the southernmost full moon of 2025. So it'll be the lowest in the sky, if you know what I mean, of the full moons this year. There's a piece of useless information for you.
Yeah, indeedy. Now, I just want to go back to the Starlink satellites, because I got a great view about 2 weeks ago of 27 of them all in a row. It was a fantastic sight, totally and utterly by accident. You can track these and follow them as well, but at this stage they will have scattered apart. And they get launched, of course, by SpaceX. Now, whether they just open the door and fire them out, I'm not quite sure. I have seen them, these little CubeSat-y type things, literally being jettisoned into space through an open door, if you like. So, and the sightings here are relatively common here in Ireland, including Dublin as well, where we are at the moment. And we often mistake them for other celestial phenomena like the ISS and things like that as well. So, why Starlink satellites are visible? This is the question, and we're going to learn a little bit more about these. It's the proximity to Earth. They orbit a little bit closer to Earth than the traditional communication satellites, making them appear brighter and more noticeable. They have great sunlight reflection, and which is why they are visible as bright objects in the night sky. To see 27 of these, Ben, all in a row, just 5 or 6 hours after they were launched, they'd been around the Earth once, I think, and came around again, a magic sight. So while we're tracking or looking at the internet just to see if you can track these as well. When satellites are launched, they often appear in a train-like formation, which I've just described, and they're deployed to move into their designated orbits. So that's why they disappear out of the line and scatter into their little orbits they are before they come around and re-burn up into the atmosphere after they've done their little bits. And speed-wise, they move faster than aeroplanes, so, and not quite as fast as the International Space Station. And you can get the odd occasional brightness fluctuation. And some of them may appear to dim and brighten as they reflect sunlight. So This is my new mission. I quite like these now. It's my first an official view, totally by accident about 2 weeks ago, of the Starlink satellites over Dublin, over County Meath, where I am, and very interesting to watch as well, so that's good fun.
Thank you, John. Actually, there's a big pilot I'm going over tomorrow in the early hours of tomorrow morning at 1:35, 1:36. Mm.
So have you added
1:37? I haven't seen them, no.
Oh, Gina, you'll be surprised, absolutely.
1:39, they all seem to be in a line. They're about the same altitude. That's heavensabove.com. Yeah. You can get those times.
Yeah, they come in from the southwest and head towards the east.
I'll have to take you over. I'm going to go out some night. I'm going to plan it.
We're going to have to plan it, yeah.
Plan it. Now, not everything that passes through the solar system originates in the solar system. It was last Wednesday when astronomers confirmed the discovery of the third ever interplanetary, I suppose, or inter... What would you say? Well, it came from another solar system, essentially. And it's an object. It was originally designated with the name 3I/Atlas. But it is likely to be the largest object from another solar system ever discovered. And it has been classified as a comet because it looks kind of fuzzy. And there seems to have some gas around it. And a couple of telescopes seem to have reported a short tail on it, and it's going through the solar system. It will pass just inside the orbit of Mars, so it won't go anywhere near us, or it won't hit Mars either, because Mars won't be at that spot when it passes through the orbit of Mars. At the moment, it's about the same distance away from us as Jupiter normally is. And it's travelling pretty fast, very fast indeed, actually 60 kilometres a second, that's about 37 miles a second, and they know from that and from tracking it that it's just going too fast to be captured by the sun. The sun will have an effect on its orbit, it will pull it in because of the massive gravity of the sun, but it's going to zoom past and it will not be bound by the sun's orbit, it will pass through. So it basically comes in one side of the solar system and passes out the other. And it was only discovered about a week ago, but then some astronomers looking back in the past data of that part of the sky, and they noticed this object. They've basically gone back, they can see it looking back at old data where it was back to June the 14th, and from that data they've calculated its orbit. And well, it's not actually in orbit, they can tell that it's in the direction it was coming, the path and the speed, that it didn't originate here in the solar system. It will, of course, like most things, brighten as it gets near the sun. It will bend slightly under the pull of gravity of the sun, and at its closest point to the sun will be next October 29th, and then it will take a few years, even at that speed, to exit the solar system. Do you remember the first one, interstellar object?
Mm-hmm.
Oumuamua. That was discovered back in 2017. That was very odd strange. That was kind of long and thin, and
it was like a big cigar, I suppose.
One prominent scientist was convinced that it was an alien vessel, but no, that didn't turn out to be the case. And the second interstellar visitor, I don't remember this one, 2L/Borisov, was spotted back in 2019. And this one is definitely not of artificial origin. And it appears to be moving considerably faster than the other two extrasolar objects that were previously discovered. And some studies are now suggesting there could be at any one time about 10,000 interstellar objects drifting through the solar system. But we don't see them. They're small, they're dim, and... But this new, I think you mentioned it last week or the week before, the new Vera C. Rubin Observatory. Mm-hmm. I reckon if there are that many, that this new observatory in Chile would be able to pick up one or two every month, perhaps. And I hope to study them. And, of course, the other thing, if they can tell whether they, from spectroscopic data and such like, if there's such things as amino acids on them, that they would give, you know, give more confidence that there is extra, not that there's extraterrestrial life, but that there are conditions that may be suitable for extraterrestrial life beyond our own solar system.
Mm, now, I know that you have some information on Michelin or Michelin star food for the ISS meals for the French astronaut. Can you imagine that it's only for... we'll go into it just a second. Just before I do that, I picked this up earlier on. And the Atacama Desert in Chile is the driest place on Earth. It faces, I suppose, 1 inch of rain a year, if even that. And they just got a rare snowfall in the driest place on Earth, which has halted all the operations of one of the world's premier telescope arrays. And this climate change may mean the observatory will face more extreme weather events like this in the future. So they got a snowfall. Yeah. Here you are, global warming for you. And the snow blanketed part of the Atacama Desert, which is, as I say, less than 1 inch of rainfall per year. And it is, of course, home to the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array, otherwise known as ALMA, which is a large network, I suppose, of radio telescopes. And they got a light covering and had to keep the roof shut, so they had to shut down operations until the chilly air disappeared. Yeah, forgive the pun. The air sort of warmed up a little bit so that the radio telescope could start working again. So remarkable to see that. It's 16,000 feet in the air, just over 16,000, which is 5,100 meters. I'm going to keep an eye on that just to see if anything has and how long that particular shutdown will last. So it's gone into survival mode as they know it.
Thank you, John. You're listening to The Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. And our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032. You can also catch us as a podcast. And hopefully from next week we'll be back live on, well, we are live on air, but that you will also be able to catch us on the internet live through the website dublincityfm.ie. Now, shall we go back to my two favourite subjects, when you mix astronomy and gastronomy.
Gastronomy, yes. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the Michelin star chef. Well, this is all for a French astronaut. Her name is Sophie Adenau, and she will be flying to the ISS next year in 2026. And when she arrives there, she will dine on the French gastronomical classics, apparently, such as lobster bisque, foie gras and onion soup, prepared for her especially by a chef, a 10 Michelin star chef. I don't get foie gras at all myself. Mm-hmm. I don't like it, and I have a an ethical objection to it as well, but that's another story. Oh yes, there'll also be parsnip and haddock velouté, chicken with tonka beans and creamy polenta, and a chocolate cream with hazelnut gazette flour. That'll all be on the menu.
Can you imagine all that's the other astronauts now, there? And they're all looking over the shoulder with gleaming eyes and saying,
can have some. So this will be no, I suppose, standard package, but all food delivered to the International Space Station must meet strict specification. Can't be too crumbly, because you don't want all of those little crumbs and bits floating around, or can't be too heavy. And you must be able to store it for up to 2 years. Now, having said that, when there's a fresh delivery of food to the International Space Station, it will contain fresh fruit, for example, and vegetables. Mm. And no doubt there's a diet for those when they arrive. But most meals are canned or vacuum packed or freeze dried from a set of options provided by the space agencies. So, but they're not all bland. Anyway, to spice things up, they say that 1 out of every 10 meals is prepared for specific crew members according to their personal tastes. And this lady, She says that during a mission, sharing our respective dishes is a way of inviting crewmates to learn more about our culture. It's a very powerful bonding experience. The 10-star Michelin chef that we mentioned is a French chef, Anne-Sophie Peak. She holds, as I said, 10 Michelin stars and was named Best Female Chef by the world's 50 best restaurants back in 2011. And she said it's an exhilarating challenge to develop the menu, which includes 4 starters, 2 mains and 2 desserts.
Oh, there you go. I remember when Tim Peake was up there as well. He had Heston Blumenthal doing his stuff. Now, he's been known for all the weird type of foods and things, but I watched the whole program on that and how they canned it and made sure it was safe to eat and everything. It took about 2 years to procure and get the licenses that you need to do that, so they won't be poisoning the astronauts in space. Aaron has just been on. He's listening on TuneIn in a little town hall in Talla at the moment. And we know that you like plays and things. He says, did we see the play Static at the Peacock?
I did not, yes. I was passing by the Abbey the other day and I saw poster, but I didn't, I wasn't aware of it.
There's a little plug for you. So he did see it and thought it was excellent and did finish with, it has a very steep and deep storyline to it. So that's going off the track a little bit, but thanks for the text there, Aaron.
Indeed. Up next, John?
The spacecraft from NASA captured detailed images of the Donald Johansson asteroid. And this is, I suppose, it looks like a big potato, pockmarked potato. So the scientists from the Lucy mission. And I actually can't remember what Lucy stands for at this stage. It's been out for a while at this stage. I forgot to look it up. And they've completed the initial analysis of data gathered during the spacecraft's April the 20th flyby on the main belt asteroid. And the picture I have in front of me is just remarkable of these weird-shaped asteroids and things. So currently, Lucy is cruising through the main asteroid belt at 30,000 miles per hour and moving farther from the Sun into the colder reaches of the solar system. And the spacecraft remains in good health as it is undergoing continuous monitoring as well. So it's going to be around in 2027 to create the main objective, which we'll encounter with the Trojan asteroid, Eurybates or Eurybates. I'm not sure what it is pronounced. And it's going to do this over a span of less than 15 months. So Lucy's expected to visit at least 6 asteroids. And isn't technology wonderful, the way it gets further and further out, sending back, beaming back photographs and information about asteroids?
Yes, John, thank you for that. I see that NASA, ever in their mission to educate and inform people, they're going to do live streams and spacewalks on Netflix. Now, you can catch most of them on the NASA TV on the internet, but it will be available on Netflix. It'll still be available free on NASA TV, and I think on the, if I'm not mistaken, they showed them on YouTube as well. Not sure about that one, but they are planning to launch live streaming programs on Netflix, which will feature rocket liftoffs, spacewalks, live views of Earth, and their plan is, of course, to bring it to the widest, broadest possible audience. And they hope to expand their global audience by more than 700 million viewers. You remember back in the Apollo 11 and those grainy images from Apollo 11? And apparently that was watched alive by 650 million people. Doesn't sound like an awful lot in some ways.
Yeah. But there weren't that many tellies around.
I was one of those 650.
I certainly was as well. I was only a little fella in shorts.
Still in my short pants too, but I remember us crowding around in the early hours of the morning. I remember asking my father, "Will you wake me up when they're going to walk on the moon?" And he did, and I was up. I thought that was the first time I was ever up at something like 10 to 4 in the morning, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, the first thing
watching those grainy images
that I remember from that was getting a book shortly after that with pictures of the moon surface and Buzz Aldrin's footprint, which was pristine. It's probably still pristine up there.
more or less, but
yeah,
it will.
Yeah, it'll erode
over
eventually.
Time, and it'll be hit by little meteoroids and such like. But so when Artemis, Artemis 2, of course, is planned to go to the moon, orbit the moon next year, and Artemis 3 to land on the moon in 2027. So the quality of the images are going to be amazing. But even it's even saying that when you if you go back and look at the images from and the TV images from Apollo 15, 16, 17, they're pretty good. But anyway, that's their plan to bring it to a wider audience via Netflix.
Now, our good friend, Mr. Trump, the president of USA, he has signed one of the big, beautiful bills, as he discovered, describes it at, including the $85 million to move the Space Shuttle Discovery from the Smithsonian Center to Texas as well. So buried in the sweeping legislation is a little sum of $85 million. It's a provision to move the most flown spacecraft from the National Collection to Space Center in Houston, in Texas. Now,
that's all very well, but at the same time, there's talk of cutting the overall NASA budget by so many billion dollars. So, be better off put into research than moving the shuttle.
Yeah, I agree with that as well. So, on July the 4th, as we remember, 2006, NASA's Shuttle Discovery launched on a return to flight mission that paved the way for it and its sister ships to fly for another 5 years after that. And that was some feat of engineering to have those fly and then come back down again so many times as well. Of course, there was the odd accident here too, but that's just one of those things, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, we had two shuttle disasters. Where shall we go next, John?
Yeah, the thing about is there life on Mars? where is this? The researchers are taking one small step towards planning life on Mars at the moment before they take the long journey to another planet. Humans are going to have to find the right place to land, which is one of the most important things. And new findings from the University of the Mississippi researchers may point to such a place on Mars. Erica Luzzi, that's the name to listen out for, and the planetary geologist and postdoctoral researcher in the Mississippi Mineral Resources Institute recently led a research effort that discovered indications of near-surface water ice on the Red Planet. So I'm sure there are numerous different places that are potential for water sources and maybe planting humans onto Mars at this stage. I suppose we just leave it as the search for life for the first Martians, if there were any.
Thank you, John. Now, Gilmore Space, they again delayed the launch of Australia's first orbital rocket. They're an Australian aerospace firm called Gilmore Space, and this is not the first time they have delayed the launch of its Eris-1 rocket, which is the country's first orbital rocket. Last Wednesday, they said it was standing down from a planned launch of what would be the first test flight of the rocket. They say it was a tough decision to postpone it, but it'll give them pause, they say, and time to essentially they'll have a longer and more flexible launch window by pausing it for a while, and they say a chance to rest after an intense few weeks of testing and preparation. When the new launch window will begin, they're not sure. It will depend on weather conditions, but not likely to be any time before July 16th. The company said that the rocket was on the launch pad, but the winds weren't favorable for a launch. Now, they had, John, previously sought to launch the rocket way back in May 15th, but they encountered problems on that date too during a routine shutdown procedures. And, that was the time when the rocket's payload fairing, which is the protective cone for the payload at the nose of the rocket, unexpectedly separated from the launch vehicle. Well, that doesn't sound too good when you're still on the launch pad. But anyway, they'll get back to it, and they will be successful, no doubt, and good luck to Australia and its It's a space program. But that's all the time we have this evening. Thank you, John, for that and for driving the sound desk. And that's all from me, Ben Emmett, from this edition of The Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. It's music all the way now till 2 a.m. Up next, Dublin's Greatest Hits. And from 10 p.m. to midnight, here to the Globe with Nigel Wood. And from midnight to 2 a.m., to After Hours with Dave Barry. Well, please join myself and John at the same time, 7:30 p.m. next week. We'll be back with all the latest news from around the universe. Until then, take care of each other. Thank you for listening. Say goodnight, John.
Good night, John.
Good night, John.
Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.